not sure where, you know, I'm not sure how, what your backgrounds are and this and that. So I do want to get some feedback. Yes.
Something that would be really helpful is if you specified maybe like which chapters in say Ashcroft's Hermit or other books.
Okay.
Like we should know, because yeah. Then kind of if we miss things in lecture, then we can rely on a solid textbook rather than trying to reference like the lectures and the notes and the slides and try to make a complete picture out of that.
Okay, yes. Thanks. So the comment was made to refer to specific chapters in either Ashcroft and Merman or some other text. So I'll try and do that more explicitly, but the notes that I'm using that are here are available, and in particular the slides. And so in all of those, I do reference like the figure number, so it's got the chapter, and most of those are from Ashcroft and Merman. So there might be more information in the notes that are online than I'm providing here, but I'll try and make a point of providing that information here as well. I use primarily Ashcroft and Merman, at least up until now, although parts of the last few lectures are not there. I also use Martyr. There's a book by Michael Martyr. Which is called not sure what it's called, Condensed Matter, something like that. So there's Ashcroft and Merman, which is often referred to simply as AM. And I also use a book by Taylor. And Heinemann. So there's a book by Taylor from 1969, I think. And then there's a second edition that's in more recent years by where he's added a co-author. No problem. Actually, today's lecture, what are you looking at? Okay. Today's lecture is actually not in or at least the first part of today's lecture is not in Ashcroft and Merman, but there's stuff in Martyr's book. Okay, and it concerns density functional theory. So this is and like any field, I think, perhaps more so in condensed matter than other fields in physics, but I doubt it, we use a lot of acronyms. And so you often this is just referred to as DFT, so density functional theory. So again, to learn more about this, one has to look at Martyr. And I think it's chapter 9, but I'm not 100% certain. Okay, you'll see it in the contents. This was started by Holmberg and Cohn in 1964, and then Cohn and Sham. In 1965, although the what's used as a primary example of density functional theory is Thomas Fermi's theory of the atom. So that goes back to the 1920s. But the formalization of this theory was done in these 2 years, and Cohn won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for this, shared it with a quantum chemist. So the idea is, the purpose of this theory is to do Well, it's used primarily to do band structure type calculations. Its overall purpose is more ambitious than that, but this is where a lot of the applications lie. And in fact, it's not just in solids that this is being used quite a bit, but also in atoms and molecules. So it's a huge field, not just in chemistry, but actually amongst the pharmaceutical companies. So they actually use this theory to get minimum energy states, and this is a guide to developing drugs and pharmaceuticals. And it's a multi-billion dollar industry, and people that do this stuff are employed by those companies. So it's got some very practical applications as well. So we're going to talk about N sub E interacting electrons. And this can be 8 for an atom, or it could be 10 to the 23rd for a solid. And the basic idea is, let me write it down, all physical properties of the system can, in principle, be determined with knowledge only of the ground state density. And this is denoted as N sub 0. So the sub 0 is for ground state, and N of R is the density. And that deserves an exclamation mark. So you have to sort of stare at that. By the way, for those, many of you are, almost all of you are not Canadian or part of the British Commonwealth. Today is Remembrance Day. So November 11th commemorates the day the armistice was signed at the end of World War I. But it's a holiday of sorts in Canada. Actually, in Alberta, all the universities are closed today. So it's traditional that at 11 o'clock, and if I could have the screen, please, I'll use the laptop for a second. So it's a traditional at 11 o'clock to observe a moment of silence in memory of soldiers primarily that fought in not just in World War I, but in all the wars to date. So we'll do that in a minute. But what I wanted to put up while we're observing that moment of silence is actually a poem written by, I don't know, who did I have this discussion with the other day? Maybe it wasn't somebody here. It's actually Canadian. The person I was talking with thought he was British, but his name is John McCrae. And it commemorates, so he's a soldier who died in the battlefield, and as he lay there dying, he wrote this poem. So there it is. So we'll just observe a moment of silence in honor of those soldiers. Okay. Thanks for that. If we can have the screen raised again, please. So Flanders, does anybody know where Flanders is? Either France or Belgium. Okay, back to density functional theory. The main statement of the theorem in 1964 is that all physical properties of the system can, in principle, be determined with knowledge only of the ground state density. Yes?
Is that all physical properties or all ground state physical properties?
All physical properties, in principle. So that's why it's amazing, and you'll see, you might not be so impressed with when I show you the logic, but this is N0 of R, right? When you solve this problem, so what do we normally do? We solve the Schrodinger equation. And we can solve for the ground state energy and the ground state wave function and all the excited states if we like. When we solve for the ground state, what do we get? We get psi 0 of R1, R2, R sub n e. So you guys haven't really been exposed, at least in this course, to a mini-body wave function. And it takes some time to figure out what a mini-body wave function is about. But this is a mini-body wave function. It depends on, you know, possibly 10 to the 23rd coordinates. It's very complicated. And if you've seen this at all, you've only seen Slater determinants, for example, which are just, or product wave functions of single particle wave functions. Well, that's the simplest case. But this has a lot of information in it. There are 10 to the 23rd, in principle, if you're doing a solid, variable. The ground state wave function, I mean, the ground state density is what? It's a mini-fold integral over the density operator. The density operator is just the sum over all the electrons, and it's given by this delta function. That's the density operator. So you know yourself, when you do an integral, you're kind of ruining information, right? You've got a function, and now you do an integral, and now you've just got a number, which gives you, say, the area under that function. That's a lot less information than the function itself. Here, you're doing 10 to the 23rd integrals. You're destroying information like crazy. You're left with a function which is only a variable, only a function of three variables in three-dimensional space. That's it. And this theorem says that actually you only need to know this. You don't need to know all of this. Now, the reason why it works is because what we're going to prove is that if you know this, you can figure this out. And then do everything that you did before. So remember H, what is H? H, and let's think for an electron system, H is consists of a kinetic energy operator. Yes?
So basically, the ground state density is an expectation value of the density of the rate of acceleration in the state.
The ground state density, yes. Yes, that's what this is. It's just like if I had the ground state energy, right? It would be the same expression, except in here I would put the Hamiltonian operator. But for the density, I put the density operator, and this is the density operator. So that Hamiltonian consists of the kinetic energy of the electrons plus some kind of external potential plus the interaction energy. So this is including interactions now, right? And that interaction is, well, since we, in kinetic matter, we know what that is. It's the Coulomb interaction, right? It's just E squared over R minus R prime. Well, a little more general than that, it's the sum over I less than J of R of E squared over RI minus RJ, where I and J enumerate all the particles in the system, the electrons. So what you have to recognize is that the kinetic energy operator and this interaction energy are universal. It doesn't matter if I'm solving for the helium atom or if I'm solving for a solid of 10 to the 23rd sodium atom, right? That's universal. Electrons move, that's the kinetic energy. So this is minus h bar squared over 2m times the sum over I equals 1 to ne times Laplacian. That's what you use when you solve the hydrogen atom. That's what I've been using when I solve for a periodic system. And this is universal. I haven't been using this because that's too complicated for what we've done so far. We're going to move into the area of interactions, but I haven't been using that so much. But those two things are completely universal. So when I tell you I'm looking at a particular system and I want to understand the properties of a particular system, what I'm saying is I'm specifying V external. So in the case of a periodic solid, I'm specifying the periodic potential with all those wells. In the case of, if I just did the helium atom, I'm solving the nuclear attractive Coulomb potential. So what I'm saying is that this quantity is what is determining everything. These things are universal. So once I know, once you give me what that is, then I go ahead and solve h psi equals psi, e psi, and then I get everything I want to know. But everything's governed by V external. Yes?
Sorry. In general, do we consider ion-ion interactions as well?
No, that's a good question. So in this, the answer is, in general, yes, but in what I'm describing to you here, no. Okay, so right now, we've done a few things. I've sort of, for example, everything I talk about today is presupposing the adiabatic approximation, or what it's sometimes called as the Born-Oppenheimer. And what that says is that if you've got things like ions, which are about 2,000 or more times heavier than the electrons, they're very slow compared to the electrons. So I can make the I can study the motion of ions, but when I do that and I make this approximation, I will look at an ion moving, but when the ion is in this position, I will calculate the electronic contributions to the energy for the ion in this position. And then I'll allow it to move, and now I'll recalculate the electronic configuration. In other words, I'm assuming that the electrons are so fast that they can simply adjust to whatever's happening to the ion. So in that sense, I'm decoupling those 2 degrees of freedom, and I'm not solving the full problem of the coupled electron and ion system. Now, here I'm going even further. When I'm setting up this kind of problem, I'm assuming an external background which is fixed. Well, it's basically the same approximation. We're going to learn about phonons in the next section. That's little lattice vibrations, and even that can be studied with this density functional theory. But they're called frozen phonon calculations. So it's just like what I described over here. You move the ion, you think of it as frozen now in time, and you calculate the electronic configuration corresponding to that particular motion. And you do that again and again as this thing moves back and forth. Good question. Any other questions? So it's V external that's determining everything, and I can write this as T plus V external plus VEE psi 0 is equal to epsilon naught psi 0. So what we want to illustrate is that what I said is true here. And we'll do this we'll do it in a simple case where we'll assume the ground state is not degenerate. But you can prove it you can relax that condition. Okay, it's just a different proof, and I'm not going to go through it because of lack of time. So assume the ground state is not degenerate. So this is, so the first thing is that if V external prime differs from V external by more than a constant, then psi naught prime is not equal to psi naught. Okay, so we're gonna prove that if you are studying that this is unique. If you study a different potential, external potential, you're gonna get a different wave function. Okay, when I write down psi naught, keep in mind, it's this really complicated thing here, the function of many variables. So the proof is simple. You write down this expression right here, and then you write down the corresponding one. Well, first of all, it's proof by contradiction. So you write that down, then you write that one down, and now you assume that psi naught prime equals psi naught, okay, in contradiction to the hypothesis. Then, if you simply subtract these two equations, you will get V external minus V external prime equaling or acting on psi naught, doesn't matter because they're both equal now, is equal to epsilon naught minus epsilon naught prime acting on psi naught. So this is in contradiction to, this should be V external like that, to V external and V external prime differing by more than a constant. Right, because now this says that these differ by epsilon naught minus epsilon prime. This is not zero by hypothesis, but it's just a constant. And so these only differ by a constant. That's a contradiction. Therefore, psi naught prime is not equal to psi naught. Okay, that's step one. Now, step two.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Can you please repeat this last part? I didn't hear it.
So, we want to show that if V external differs from V external prime differs from V external by more than a constant, then that implies that psi naught prime is not equal to psi naught. Okay, so I have two systems. One with V external and one with V external prime. The kinetic energy and the interaction is the same for both because they're just electrons that interact and move. And they both obey, so presumably psi naught prime is the ground state energy for this system and psi naught is the ground state energy for that system. They have different energies, epsilon and epsilon naught prime, ground state. To prove that this is true, I use proof by contradiction, so I assume it's true. If it's true, if this is psi naught and not psi naught prime, if the same psi naught is there, then I can just take these two equations and subtract them. The T and the V sub EE will cancel out. And when I subtract them, I get this. And this says that the external potentials just differ by a constant, which I said, no, they have to differ by more than a constant. So that's a contradiction to my assumptions, and therefore this assumption must be wrong. So it says that psi naught prime is not equal to psi naught. Is that okay? So step two is that we have to prove that n naught of r is not equal to n naught prime of r. Okay, so we're proving that it's unique. If I have a particular V external, that leads me to a particular psi sub zero, which leads me to a particular n sub zero. Yeah?
One more question about that maybe it's a silly question, but I don't know. What would happen if we had some sort of localized wave function, and we have these two potentials, but the wave function is localized in a one part was they are, they only differ by a constant, but on other places, just they are different. Maybe it's not possible to make such a construction, but I don't know.
I guess it. So I think what you're asking about. So the question is, what happens if you've got a situation where the electrons are localized, and then, but the potential only differs at somewhere that's irrelevant to that localization. So I think you're sort of saying, what happens if you have this kind of potential versus, you know, that kind of potential where the white one just carries on like that, the ground state density is all there, and who cares about I'm not 100% sure of the answer, but my guess is that the theorem holds that they will be different, but they might be different in the
Okay. Like that's what it seems to me
Is
so the theorem is true. And it's not clear that the theorem is useful, is what you're pointing out. And I think that's valid. I think that's a valid remark, but it's true in principle. And because it's true in principle, then, well, first let's prove this, and then I'll say what I want to say. We prove that, okay, and the way to prove that is we look at epsilon naught is equal to psi zero h psi zero, and that is less than psi zero prime h psi zero prime. That's just the variational principle. If I choose a wave function that's not the ground state, psi zero is the ground state here by hypothesis, then if it's not the ground state, it'll have an expectation value higher in energy. And then this can be written as so this piece here is just the Hamiltonian that corresponds to that ground state psi naught prime. So this is going to equal epsilon naught prime plus this expectation. And this is a one-body potential, right? I think I made it clear. It's something each electron experiences as an external potential. So what this says is that epsilon naught is less than epsilon naught prime plus that. Now, what can we do with this? This is, let me write it out, this is the integral d cubed r1, d cubed rme times psi naught prime of r1 rme its conjugate times. What's the V external operator? Well, it's just the sum over I equals 1 and E of V external RI. So that acts on every single one of the electrons. And then you write psi naught prime of R1 Rn. And then inside here, you simply insert 1. Okay, if I put that in there, that's 1. Right? I'm allowed to put 1 anywhere I like because the integral of the delta function over all space is 1. So I put that in there. But as soon as I put that in there, I'm allowed to change R sub I into R because it's a delta function. Right? So the integral of dx of f of x, well, this is more like the integral of f of x naught times delta x minus x naught is the same thing as the integral dx f of x times delta of x minus x naught. Right? Usually you go the other way. Usually you have this, and you say, wow, it's a delta function, so it's always going to be f of x naught. And you go from here to there, but you can go from here to there. And if you do that here, then I've got the integral d cubed r of d external of r, because I can take that out now. I've replaced it by r. And everything else in there is exactly what I wrote up here, the n sub 0. So this is just n sub 0 of r. So in fact, what I've shown is that epsilon naught is less than epsilon naught prime plus integral d cubed r d external of r minus d external of r prime. Times and not of r. And I, by the way, I'm going to prove this by contradiction as well. I'm going to say, so assume n naught of r is equal to n naught prime of r, and show that it leads to a contradiction. The way I do that is I repeat the same argument, but this time I start with epsilon naught prime. And that's going to be less than the one with psi naught. Yeah.
I mean, in the line where you have epsilon naught less than epsilon naught prime, it's b prime of r, right? So b of r prime.
Sorry, you're right. This should be right.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is going to be less than skipping some steps because it's exactly as I've got over there. I'm going to say it's less than the expectation value of h prime with psi 0. And then that's going to be less than epsilon naught plus integral d cubed r d external prime of r minus d external r times n naught. And so these two statements, this one and that one, if I call this, let me call this A, I've got epsilon naught less than epsilon naught prime plus A, but then this statement says epsilon naught prime is less than epsilon naught minus A, because this is just the negative of that. If I add these two equations, then I have epsilon naught plus epsilon naught prime is less than epsilon naught plus epsilon naught prime, which is impossible here in fact. Okay, therefore, this is wrong, and therefore, N naught of R is not equal to N naught of R prime. So I've determined that V external, as long as it differs from another one by more than a constant, uniquely determines the ground state density. If it uniquely determines the ground state density, that means I can go backwards. If somebody tells me what the ground state density is, I can figure out what V external is. If I can figure out what V external is, I can solve this equation and get everything I want to know. So this then gets you thinking that all you need to know to determine the properties of a many-body system is a functional of the ground state density. And if you can figure out what that functional is, then you are set. There's another variational theorem that says that minimizing that functional will give you the correct answer. Okay, so that's the Homberg-Cohn theorem. And let me write what I just said down more formally. So it says that epsilon naught is equal to psi naught, this expectation value, and that this will be the minimum of some energy function. Yeah. Is everybody here familiar with what functional is?
Been doing a lot of battery.
You have? Okay, so it's just the simplest representation is the classical Coulomb energy. This is an example of a functional of the density. So as opposed to being a function of a variable, it's a functional of a function. So N of R can vary in space. And it's just like you did in third year classical mechanics when you derived Euler-Lagrange equations. You started with an action, and then you minimize the action. And that was a functional of the position of the particle. And therefore, you determine what amounts to the classical trajectory of that particle. So, the variational principle that goes on along with this is that the ground state energy is is going to be always less than this energy for any density n. Not equal to the ground state density. If you have the ground state density distribution in there, then you will get the minimum energy. So, and this expression is going to equal what we'll call F of HK of N plus V external of R. Okay, and this Holmberg-Cohn functional is basically it's psi times t plus v e e times psi. Writing it out like this is useful because this is something you could determine once and for all. As I said, it's universal. And around 1980-81, there's a sort of a famous quantum Monte Carlo simulation for sintering electron gaps. Okay, and that study, so that was by Sepperly and Adler. It's a PRL around 1980 or 81. And what what has come about out of that is a sort of a parameterization for what this functional is. Okay? So and there's been a ton of work since then to try and figure out what that functional is. And then the V external, the problem you want to solve, goes in. So, as I mentioned, the first example, which we understand to be an example in hindsight, was Thomas-Fermi. And in fact, we should throw in Dirac. This is a Dirac we put in the exchange. So I don't know if any of you ever studied this problem. So it's for an atom. And these were done in 1927, and Dirac came along 1930. So just to give you a flavor, that in Thomas Fermi theory, you can write down a functional for the energy, which, let me write it down, it's h bar squared over 2m times 3/5 times 3 pi squared 2/3 times the integral d cubed r n 5/3 R. And if n were not a function of R, if it were a constant, you might actually recognize this. I don't know if you covered the free electron case in August, but if you did, you would have had this expression where this would have just been a constant out here n to the 5/3. Plus the integral d cubed R of n of r v external plus 1/2 integral d cubed r 1 and then the Dirac piece was this so-called exchange. student right now. So that's the energy functional, and if you take the functional derivative of that subject to a constraint of fixed particle number, and this is where the chemical potential comes in. So you're used to dealing with this when you're dealing with the grand canonical ensemble. Then this implies, so if you just take the functional derivative of this, you will get h bar squared over 2m, 3 pi squared thirds, n to the 2/3 r plus the external r plus e squared integral b cubed r prime is n of r prime over r minus r prime. Minus 3 over pi to the 1/3 e squared n to the 1/3 r, and that's equal to mu. So mu is a parameter now that sets the number of electrons in the ball. And you can, Thomas and Fermi solved this in some approximation, but you can solve this equation nowadays numerically, and that gives you a density profile for the particular. So if you were doing an atom, this would be the Coulomb potential associated with the nucleus. And actually, I've written it down here on these notes. This is discussed in Martyr on page 270. Okay, so there's Let me go on and tell you a little bit about Cohn and Sham. Because what Cohn and Sham did immediately following this theorem was come up with a practical description for solving these problems. And basically the philosophy was to use a non-interacting reference . So this is completely fictitious. It's like a reference system where somehow there's no electron-electron interactions, because you know this is what messes you up. So you use a non-interacting reference, sometimes called an auxiliary system, and now you find, it's a very convoluted way of thinking, but it works, you find an external potential. We'll call V Cohn Sham of R. So it's an external potential, so it just depends on the one coordinate R, that produces the same ground state density as
ME electron problem. And the any, this is the interacting electron problem. There's another book where I've taken some of this from, but you guys will be looking at books for the rest of your life. It's by Richard Martin. And it's called Electronic Structure. So the whole book is basically on this stuff. And it's advanced. And chapter 7 is really this stuff. It's actually chapter 7 begins with a quote, which comes from somewhere. Maybe you made it up. If you don't like the answer, change the question. Right? And that's what this is. This is sort of changing the question. So, because if you produce the same ground state density, then in principle, you're going to have all the properties of the system you want to solve. Now, the difference is that you have to figure out what this Cohn-Sham potential is that will get you. And because, so again, this means that for this system, I'll use the subscripts case of S for Cohn-Sham. The Hamiltonian is the kinetic energy plus this external potential. But this kinetic energy, this is where it gets a little confusing perhaps, this is not that universal kinetic energy anymore. Because this is a fictitious system that only has an external potential, no V sub EE. So now, some of the features that are going to make this system identical in what it predicts to the system you want to solve are going to be wrapped up in here. Okay, so that's a different function. And the same Homberg-Cohn theorem implies that there's a functional for this system, which we'll call epsilon k sub s of n, which is equal to this, and then that one is more readily written down. Why do you want to do this? Because if it's a non-interacting reference system, so then you can write down NKS of R, you can write down the density as just summing over all the electrons now. Times that. Where these are single particle wave functions. So have you guys encountered Slater determinants? You know what a Slater determinant is? So basically, instead of that complicated first sort of down here, instead of that complicated mini-body wave function here, what Hartree did was simply write it as a product. So instead of that thing, you just wrote it as a product of these single particle functions. So psi naught r1 rne was equal to phi naught of r1. We'll have to call it phi A of R1, phi B of R2, phi C of R3, and so on. This is much, much, much easier than trying to figure out the full
free body weight function. And then Falk came along, and Slater as well, and corrected Partree's initial product state here, because this product state isn't anti-symmetric in the electron variables, in the fermions, so it has to be anti-symmetric. So they made it anti-symmetric, and Slater formulated this thing called the Slater determinant, which automatically does that. So Slater determinant ends up being a whole bunch of these, but never mind that, it's just basically a product. And it's those individual wave functions that you can now solve for using the Cohn-Sham Schrodinger equation, which I'll write down right now, which is much easier compared to trying to solve, say, the original Schrodinger equation, which is a mini body. All right. So if you take the original Schrodinger equation and you want to solve for mini bodies, and you don't have an interaction potential, you don't have this V sub EE, then essentially, automatically, the solution is this product state, anti-symmetrized with your fermions, and the Schrodinger equation that you have to solve, which is the same as that one, but now reduced, is a single particle Schrodinger equation. And single particle Schrodinger equations, you can solve. Numerically, you have to, but you can solve. Without much problem. The problem is you don't know what this is. And what I'll show you now is that you can solve this iteratively by constructing this on each iteration. So let's look at this. So let's start with the interacting system. For the interacting system, we have this functional, the one I wrote here, basically, okay, which is a functional of the density. This is for the interacting system. So it's going to be equal to T, which is that original kinetic energy operator down there. So that's some functional of the density, plus V electron-electron, plus this explicit integral over the density times the external potential. Right? That's what I wrote over there. Except now I'm going to subtract this thing and add it. And then I'm also going to subtract, this is sort of just a, somewhat of a convention, I'd say. But So this is the classical Hartree interaction energy. So I've subtracted it, so I have to add it. So I can't just, and I haven't been using SI units, so I'm gonna move that out. E squared one half integral d q dar, d q dar prime. So I've written this in a specific way, and let me now write it as the Cohn-Sham functional plus the exchange correlation functional. So this is all lumped together and called the exchange correlation function. And it's something you don't know. Plus E squared, just this term here above, E squared over 2, n of r prime. Like that, and plus this next term. And if you look what this exchange is, it's equal to, so let me write it over here, this exchange correlation functional is equal to that original Homberg-Cohn functional, so that f sub Homberg-Cohn was the universal functional, which we don't, we certainly don't know it analytically, but we can get a handle on it numerically from that study from 1980, for example, and all the studies that have happened since. And you subtract the Hartree term. So this is sort of like the classical Coulomb repulsion. And you're subtracting the Cohn-Sham function. So you've got to handle, we don't know this exactly, and we never will. But there's a whole army of people out there, bigger than you think, that are working at getting ever better functional schemes. So that's sort of something we can, people use the latest and greatest. This we know, and this we need. This is what we have to come up with for both here and here. So we apply Homberg-Cohn, which says that this thing is equal to zero. So if we take this, and now that's working at this expression, then we get this functional derivative. So the part that other people are working on are approximations for this Cohn-Sham function. And you'll hear buzzwords, well, like LDA is local density approximation. You remember I flashed up the citations to some reference that had 50,000 citations plus. That was one of these papers that had produced the generalized gradient approximation, so the GGA. That's what gets you 50,000 citations. So if you come up with the something, something A, you'll maybe get cited the law as well. And then this one, we can do explicitly. By taking the functional derivative. Then we have B external, and this is somebody hands you that because that's the problem they want to solve. And then you have this functional, which this is just the functional derivative of the exchange correlation, but you call it a potential. Because now it looks like an external potential, and it basically looks like this. Except it depends on n, which is the very thing you're trying to solve for. So, and that is equal to zero. Meanwhile, the Cohn-Sham equation says that delta t, that's relatively simple. And it tells you that that's equal to zero. Where this is equal to, this is in the way probably, right? So I hope most of you can see this equation and BKS now. Is equal to V external of R plus B squared plus the exchange correlation. So this up. And let me summarize the strategy. So the strategy is one. Trial density profile for the ground state determines Cohn-Sham potential. Right? Because if we've got a trial density, then we can stick it in here, and we can determine V exchange correlation through that functional derivative there, provided we're given a Cohn-Sham functional for kinetic energy. So that's something we have to use. And as I mentioned there are ever better functionals on the market like LVA or GGA, general local density approximation and general gradient approximation. So you determine the Cohn-Sham potential, then you solve the Cohn-Sham Schrodinger equation. Then you can use the equation that this equation here to determine the density profile. And that's going to be different from the trial one. So now you go back to step one and use this potential and repeat this procedure iteratively until hopefully you get convergence. And that's how you end up solving for the electron density. So the part that I'm going to have to stop this part here is the part that should be a little bit, or a lot fuzzy, is this Cohn-Sham potential. Okay, and that's something that people try, and they keep getting improved estimates for what that functional is, and proceed in that manner. And so, and the test is then in sort of comparing to experiments. And in the extreme case that I mentioned earlier, if you're working for a pharmaceutical company, you're not just comparing to experiments, you're actually making tons of money for this company because you're using these calculations to determine what sort of what sort of pharmaceuticals will actually form and what some of their properties will have. And this is being used to produce more pharmaceuticals. So it's actually being used in that area. Okay, I wanted to give you a quick introduction to this just because it's so prevalent in condensed matter these days. This was a little more than just a quick introduction. I just hope you got some appreciation of what happened. I don't think you can really get a good appreciation unless you sit down and start doing these kinds of calculations. And they're, to be honest, it's a field that's despised by part of the condensed matter community because it looks like it's very recipe driven. And you've got theorems and everything to back you up, but you don't seem to have a controlled way of moving forward to, for example, develop better functions. It's a more hit and miss type of approach, and it's working. It's eventually people are coming up with better descriptions of not only condensed matter systems, but atoms and molecules. The chemists use this methodology over everything else now. They no longer use any of the very few people left in quantum chemistry using the standard approaches that were used 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Okay, so let's see, what should I do? I think what I'm going to do is I'll take 5 more minutes of your time and just skim the surface of cohesion in solids, and then on Monday we'll start with bonons, these lattice vibrations. So what's cohesion in solids? I think somebody asked about it earlier in the week. Which was, while we went through all these Bravais lattices, before I go to that, any other questions here? Yes.
So what is the difference between the VEE term and the R3 term?
The VEE term, so the VEE term is I know the difference. I'm just trying to figure out how to say it. The Hartree term is, first of all, it's very classical. It's just a classical potential energy. The VEE term shows up in the Schrodinger equation. Right, so the Schrodinger equation you have to solve for psi. And then eventually, so if you take the VEE term and operate on psi, well, if you take all of this and if you were able to solve it, you could not write it like that. Okay, I'm not sure. Does everybody appreciate that? You can't simply write VE acting on psi in that manner. So let's put it another way. If you take psi naught. Psi naught of R1, R2, R and E star integral d cubed R1, d cubed R and E. Then this is some I less than j of E squared over Ri minus Rj times psi naught of R1. Right, that's the expectation value. So your question tells me that you're thinking that if I simply manipulate this, I get that. Is that right?
I mean, I don't know the difference now, so I just wanted to know how they're different.
That's an approximation. So we're referring to you're referring to this term right here, right?
Right.
That's an approximation to this expectation value. So we are going to do Hartree-Fock theory in a few lectures. Maybe that will make it clear. If I write this as a product state of single particle wave functions, which I wrote down on one of the boards, then this will reduce to that. If I write it down as a Slater determinant, so a little better than the product state, Slater determinant means that the product state is anti-symmetrized now, then this will not reduce to that. Even that approximation won't give me that. It'll give me that exchange term. You remember that there's going to be an exchange term that comes out. This is just the direct term, so-called Hartree term. The exchange term is even more complicated than that. So I guess the answer to the question is that is an approximation, and actually I know exactly when I get that. I get that exactly when I write this as a product. So I write down the psi naught of R1, R, and E is equal to 5A of R1, 5B of R2, 5B of R. Where these are state labels that are not specifying at the moment. But what I said is that this can be written as a proxy. That's a huge approximation. If I make that approximation, then I'll get this thing reducing to the heartbeat. If I even go one step further, as I said, so I'm repeating myself, but if I go one step further and anti-symmetrize this, I still get a severe approximation. It's called a Hartree-Fock approximation. And I get that term plus the exchange. So the exchange term, maybe I'll do that problem next week. You guys encountered the Dirac pole? So if you maybe I'll just describe the problem. If you take an electron gas and you calculate a particle-particle correlation function between two particles that don't interact with one another. If those two particles, if one of them is spin up and one of them is spin down, does anybody know what the answer for the distribution will look like of the how far away one particle is from the other? They don't interact with one another. It's constant. They don't know about one another. They're oblivious. If I take the same two particles now, still don't interact with one another, but they're both spin up. So, yes, they don't interact with one another, but they do obey the Pauli exclusion principle. Then that particle-particle correlation function as a whole. And where the first particle is, the second particle won't be there, because it can't be there because of the Pauli exclusion principle. And it's a hole with a specific healing length, if you like, and then far away it will be that constant distribution. So that's referred to as the Dirac pole, and that's specifically a feature of anti-symmetrization. So that's the difference between that Hartree term and the Hartree term and the Fock term, both of which are approximations to this. So neither of them are faithfully representing that. Anyways, it's a good question. Okay, so that eats up all the time. So that means it's time to move. So on Monday, we're either going to start writing the pronouns or I'll say a few words about cohesive energy. Cohesive energy is chapter 20 in Ashcroft and Merman, and Phonons is chapter 22. So that's where we'll be.